I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, we present a community forum on the recent executive order on immigration. Our panelists are Medea Ahusain of Muslim Advocates, Jonathan Blazer of the American Civil Liberties Union, Grisel Ruiz of Immigrant Legal Resource Center, and Rabbi Peretz Wolf-Pruzan of Lairhouse Judaica. They're joined by Peter Waldman of Bloomberg News. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces our guests.
So 75 years ago, almost to the day, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed an executive order clearing the way for the forced relocation of Japanese Americans in the tens of thousands, 60% of whom were born in America. There are incredible lessons that can be learned from this chapter of American history, especially as politicians and their surrogates volley around ideas like the Muslim registry and Japanese American incarceration as a precedent, as well as new executive orders coming out every week. In these uncertain times, it's our responsibility as Americans and as Jews to reveal the fragility of our democracy and the need to stay vigilant in protecting it for us all. And with this in mind, I'd like to introduce tonight's moderator, Peter Waldman. Peter is a reporter and editor at Bloomberg News. Prior to Bloomberg, he was at the Wall Street Journal for more than 20 years, reporting from all corners of the world. Peter will do the honors of introducing the panelists and getting the program off the ground. Peter.
Thank you, Stephanie. Many of us wake up these days after a restless night's sleep from watching too much cable news and wonder what strange and twisted tweet or executive order will come out today. The fact is that when bullying and bigotry suddenly become enshrined in the law, as they were in the president's executive orders on immigration, and more so, I would say, in today's deportation guidelines from the Department of Homeland Security that we'll be talking a lot about tonight, the effect is sort of like a fog of war, disorienting and rendering, I think, a feeling of helplessness. Tonight, I hope our panel can show us that not all is lost, how some check or balance in the system is lurking to right what is clearly listing. And I hope that we can take something away that will invigorate all of us to work on some of these issues. With that, I'm going to sit down. I think we'll introduce the folks a little bit as we move along on our panel, and also I will ask them to talk a little bit about some of the organizations that they represent, some less well known than others. I want to start just to my right here with Jonathan Blazer of the ACLU, who works on policy issues. Jonathan, tell us a little bit about your position at the ACLU, what you do, and if you would, frame the legal challenges, the legal issues that we're facing at this point along the sort of waterfront of executive orders and Homeland Security guidelines and so forth.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. So my name is John Blazer, and I work for the National Political Advocacy Department of the ACLU. I am not a litigator, but I admire a lot of the litigators that I work with, and I work very closely with them. But we're also focused on trying to change the political environment in this country, well aware that there's a resistance movement afoot. And I think we're witnessing that happening now with the protests at the airports and the way in which resistance at the political level and on the streets can shape how courts think about the important decisions that they need to make. I'm going to provide a little bit of a quick overview of the three executive orders that have come down relating to immigration, and refugee admissions by the Trump administration. There's a lot of developments happening. There were leaked memos this weekend and then final memos issued today. And we may see a replacement executive order of the Muslim and refugee ban as early as tomorrow. So things are a bit in flux, but I think we still can summarize what we're seeing. And I think it's clear that what we are seeing so far is a bringing to life, at least in blueprint version, of some of the most extreme elements of Donald Trump's campaign rhetoric. For those of us who thought that he didn't really mean it when he said it during the campaign, I don't know if whether he meant it or not, but he's following through on the most extreme versions of his proposals so far. And let me lay them out quickly. There was a executive order on interior enforcement, that is enforcement inside the country away from the borders. It proposed to triple the number of immigration and customs enforcement officials, people who will be part of Trump's deportation force. It's a proposal. Congress still needs to appropriate money, and this is critical for those of us who want to influence the political process. Trump doesn't get to decide to triple the amount he spends on ICE. Congress decides that, and we all have representatives in Congress that we need to reach out to make sure they don't approve those funds. It makes almost everybody who is an undocumented immigrant in the United States an enforcement priority. Under the Obama administration, there was a dividing line at the risk of oversimplification for people who had committed serious crimes and were convicted of those crimes. Donald Trump's executive order throws that out the window and says, I don't care whether you're convicted of a crime. If you're charged with a crime, whether or not convicted, even if you were never charged of a crime, but we believe that you committed acts which constitute a crime, and we don't care what kind of crime, you're a priority for deportation. It's almost as though ICE gets to decide, you look like a bad hombre to me, and therefore you're a priority for deportation. I don't care if you're arrested or if you go to court or have due process. I think you probably committed a crime. It dramatically expands a very dangerous program that has led to widespread racial profiling and pretextual arrests by police. It's referred to by the section of the Immigration Code as the 287G program, but basically it enables local law enforcement agencies to directly enforce the immigration laws, and Trump calls for expanding that program to the maximum. And then it threatens to defund, quote-unquote, sanctuary cities such as San Francisco and several East Bay and South Bay communities. These are communities who have decided as a matter of public safety and inclusive values and upholding the Constitution to treat all of their residents equally, and Trump threatens to penalize them. Again, it's just a threat so far, and there will be major fights by sheriffs and police chiefs who disagree with Donald Trump over this. So that's the Interior Enforcement Executive Order. There's also a Border Executive Order, and the most well-known part of that is Build the Wall. So far, the executive order and the memo that came out today instructs DHS to start planning on building the wall. There's still no money to build that wall. Mexico said it's not going to pay for it. It's not clear yet whether Congress is going to pay the 20-something billion dollars needed to build the wall proposed. Again, there's an opportunity to stop this in its tracks through Congress, through the funding mechanism, and there are certain to be lawsuits by environmental groups, by Native American groups, by civil liberties groups against the wall once it starts being built, if it starts being built. The Border Enforcement Executive Order also maximizes the detention of border crossers and makes it as hard as possible for people to get a fair shot in court to be able to stay here by trying to declare a lot of individuals ineligible to be able to seek asylum or present their case in front of a court by expediting the removal from the country. And I want to just say about the border enforcement order, we don't think of ourselves here in San Francisco as being part of the border. But under the law, theoretically, if ICE wants to treat people in San Francisco with less due process and constitutional rights than in other parts of the country, it can claim that we are part of the border. The border is defined as the part of the country that is 100 miles from the land border or port of entry. We are all the border here. Most of California's population lives in the border. We have a huge role to play here in California in determining whether or not the wall gets built or these other border measures get stepped up through our political representatives in Congress. Congress. And then finally, the order that probably has gotten the most attention is the Muslim and refugee ban, which for now is enjoined by the courts. And this was a ban that suspended immigration from 7 Muslim-majority countries, and that also suspended all refugee admissions for a period of time. And we got to witness democracy in action a few weeks ago when people immediately, almost spontaneously, showed up at airports demanding that people be let in, including green card holders who had lived here for decades and were mid-flight when this sloppily drafted order came down. And the ACLU and some of our key partners, such as the National Immigration Law Center and the International Refugee Assistance Committee, filed lawsuits. We actually filed 12 lawsuits across the country. And I think we have to be lucky that we've got great lawyers and organizers fighting, but also that courts are taking serious their responsibility. They enjoined the law from being implemented, and people are now traveling from those countries. And they pushed the Trump administration into a position in where, even though Donald Trump immediately tweeted, "I'll see you in court," suggesting he was going to appeal this to the Supreme Court, I think his lawyers advised him that your order is doomed, and you have to rewrite this thing and republish it. I think most of us on this panel will predict that they will not succeed in erasing the stain of religious discrimination. There's still going to be a ban against Muslim-majority countries. They're going to exempt green card holders, lawful permanent residents, and maybe some other current visa holders, which is a no-brainer, really, from a legal perspective. But Donald Trump can't take away what he said. And what he said reveals his intent. He said that he was going to set forth a complete and total ban on Muslim immigration. And he's tried to scale it back the first time. He's going to try to scale it back this time. But it will remain discriminatory both in intent and content. Courts will continue to look at it seriously, and we will continue to fight this in court.
Thank you, John. I'd like now to move to Grisel Ruiz, who is with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. And Grisel, I'd like you to sort of tell us a little about the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, but also talk about the communities you're working with and the work you do at a time like this.
Sure thing. Well, thanks for all of your time today. So my name is Grisel Ruiz. I'm a staff attorney at the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. And just briefly about our organization. Our organization does policy and advocacy at the local, state, national level. So, for example, we work with partners such as the ACLU to draft several of the pending state bills right now that were introduced in December in response to the current president's promises of everything that he's setting out to do. We also do a lot of work with immigrants on the ground. For example, we go out into the communities and do Know Your Rights presentations, reminding immigrants that even in these times, there are certain rights that they have, certain rights under the Constitution that not even this president or any other president can take away. We also engage in other types of advocacy and education, but we really are a policy and resource center. I also have my colleague Mark Silverman here in the audience as well. And I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of pulling back the veil in terms of the communities that this is affecting. And my colleague here is going to talk about the Muslim community. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the immigrant community at large. I am an immigrant myself. I'm certainly sitting in more of a position of privilege today because today I am a U.S. citizen. But when I first came to this country when I was 2 years old, I was undocumented. My parents were undocumented. And because of some call it amnesty, I call it luck, I'm sitting here now with status. And not only with status, but with the greatest protection that you have, you know, being a U.S. citizen. And my quick plug for any folks who have green cards out there, become a U.S. citizen. That is your frontline defense. And that actually also leads me into the first thing that I was going to talk about, which is who is affected. So we have U.S. citizens, not affected, at least by these orders directly, certainly affected in a lot of collateral ways, but everybody else, any other non-citizen, can conceivably be affected. So people traditionally think of undocumented people. I still have a lot of undocumented folks in my own family, and I know we all here are touched by folks who are without status, but it's so many other people as well. We're talking refugees, we're talking asylees, we're talking green card holders who could conceivably be affected by these orders and who are already being affected just by the sheer fear of what's happening. So just to give a sense of the huge amount of people, and you know, there's obviously it's hard to know the exact number, but people tend to cite the 11 million figure for undocumented people, but again, it's so many people even beyond the folks who would come into that undocumented category. And then in terms of how people are ensnared by the system, well, certainly the executive orders and this president has made clear his desire to ramp up the deportation system. But let's be clear, he is being handed over the keys to a very well-oiled deportation machine. I wish I could tell you that this is new. I wish I could tell you that this is the first that we're seeing of people being taken without due process, without any advisal of their rights, you know, but no. This is nothing new. You know, even under the previous administration, we actually saw more deportations under that administration than any other administration combined. Certainly, this president is hoping to increase that number that much more, which is a frightening thought. But the scary thing is that the machinery is in place. And it can happen in all sorts of different ways. So someone who maybe has a deportable offense that could be a minor offense from many years ago, they apply to become a U.S. citizen, they could be flagging themselves for deportation. And also, just again, to underscore how broken the system already is, just a few more points. When people are placed in deportation proceedings, in civil deportation proceedings, there's no absolute right to an attorney in the same way that there is in the criminal justice system. For example, you have the right to an attorney, but not at the government's expense. In fact, a very common stat is that at the national level, when it comes to folks fighting their cases detained, about 84% of people are unrepresented. So you're talking immigration law, which many people say is the most complex area of law, second to tax. Imagine being confined, possibly states away from your loved ones, unrepresented, having to fight your deportation case. People are absolutely set up to fail. So again, just underscoring how broken the system already is and the importance in the face of this for our communities, our leaders, to stand up and fight back.
Thank you, Grizel. Now I'd like to ask Madia Ahusain, who is with an organization called Muslim Advocates, to tell us a little bit about her group, your group, as well as talk about the community you serve and how they're coping.
Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. And I first want to start by saying that Muslim Advocates and the Muslim community stand with the Jewish community in the face of hatred and bigotry and vandalism and just horrific acts of violence against the Jewish community. As someone who, as a staff attorney at Muslim Advocates, part of my job is to track and monitor hate crimes and also just, get a better sense of what the anti-Muslim movement looks like in this country. And when I heard about what happened at the Jewish cemetery in Missouri, it was unfortunately a reminder to me that an attack on any community is an attack on us all. And this is an important opportunity for us now as we think about these executive orders to recognize that our communities need to stand with one another. We are all impacted by these issues in many ways, as my colleagues have mentioned. And whether it's a Muslim ban, an immigration ban, a refugee ban, whatever we call it, it's going to have very serious impact on all of our lives in many different ways. And I think it's a true test of what the values that we have as a country and what we want to stand for as humanity and as individuals. So thank you for this opportunity to talk about this. So I want to just touch briefly upon what was discussed when we're talking about this idea of a Muslim ban, as was already previously mentioned by a few of my colleagues, but particularly what John said about the executive order. The current status of the previous executive order is that it doesn't have the teeth that they thought they had before when they signed it into effect initially because of the court orders. And so now people that were perceived to have been impacted by that should be free to go about whatever it was that they wanted to do in terms of travel and entering into the country. However, that does not mean that people are not being harassed at the border. Whether they are U.S. citizens, green card holders, visa holders, whatever it is, they are being allowed back in. It doesn't mean that they are not being questioned. It doesn't mean that they are not being given a hard time when they're trying to come back into the country. And this does include U.S. citizens.
You're listening to the Executive Order on Immigration, a community forum, featuring Medea Ahusain of Muslim Advocates, Jonathan Blazer of the American Civil Liberties Union, Grisel Ruiz of Immigrant Legal Resource Center, and Rabbi Peretz Wolf-Pruzan of Lairhouse Judaica. They're joined by Peter Waldman of Bloomberg News. On Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So prior to the court order, going back a couple of weeks, we saw complete chaos because of how terribly and sloppily, as you said, the executive order on the Muslim entry and the refugees, how terribly it was written. And this is reminiscent of a previous program that was actually dismantled towards the end of the Obama administration that was referred to as the NSEERS, which is the National Security and Entry and Exit Registration System program. And that was a program that was established under the Bush administration. And it was designed essentially to register individuals that were not U.S. citizens coming from certain countries if they were above the age of either 16 or 18, I can't remember. They're male individuals from these countries were required to come forward and register in this system. So the idea of a Muslim registry is not a new idea, unfortunately. But what happened was after a few years, the administration stopped enforcing this. And so they had it still on the books. It was still valid law, but they decided not to enforce it. And then what they did was they started to remove countries from the required list of registration. And it essentially became a law that was on the books that wasn't being utilized. So through the great work of a number of organizations and advocacy institutions over the last few months of the tail end of the administration, we were able to get that dismantled so that if President Trump wanted to reinstate this, he would have to do it from scratch and he would have to go through the process of getting approval by Congress. So the reason why this Muslim ban reminds me of that program is because there was no guidance. Was also complete chaos. There were people that were being detained because they didn't know what to do with these individuals that had not come forward and registered by that date that they were required to register by. And here you have the same thing happening. People were at airports. They didn't know what to do, and so they just detained them. So you had a 5-year-old boy who is a U.S. citizen who was perceived to be a threat and separated from his mother for hours at the Dulles International Airport, because there was no guidance. You had a mother who was a breastfeeding mother who was separated from her 11-month-old child for hours in Texas because there was no guidance on what was supposed to happen. And that's just two examples of hundreds of stories of individuals that were separated from their families, that were completely confused about what they were supposed to do, where to find help, whether they were even allowed to get help. Those lawyers that were fighting for the rights of these individuals to be let free, they weren't communicating with these people. They were just asking for them to be released so that then they could try to communicate with them. So there was no guidance as to what was supposed to happen. And I remember watching a video, I think it was at the Seattle Washington airport, of the I can't even remember who it was, but he was speaking so passionately about how terrible this was and how unprofessional, how completely despicable it was for the leader of this country to institute this law and not give any guidance to employees of the federal government on how to enforce this. And I think what we are concerned about now is what the second edition of this is going to look like. I think what my colleague John said is absolutely correct, in that no matter what tomorrow or whether it's delayed until the next day's executive order says, he cannot wipe away what he said before, which was that he wanted to institute a complete and total ban of Muslims entering this country. So no matter how much he tries to wipe that away in the language of the executive order, it's not possible to erase that. And the communities that we're dealing with, my colleague here, myself, my colleagues at my institution, we are prepared to challenge this in the same way that we challenged the previous executive order. Before I end, just so you all know, Muslim Advocates is a national legal advocacy and education organization that works to protect the rights of individuals practicing their faith, whether it's of any faith or of no faith. And the idea being that people here have the right to pray freely, whatever, in whatever way they want. And what we have done with respect to the Muslim ban specifically is that we have been creating resources to educate the community on what this means for them, how it may impact them and their family members. And also we have been supporting the legal challenges that have been put in place. So we wrote and filed what we call amicus briefs, which are friend of the court briefs, to support these legal challenges that were against the executive order, and we are prepared to do that again if we have to, and we continue to keep the community apprised of what these developments mean. So we are ready and able to respond when the next executive order comes out, and I look forward to continuing these conversations with you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Medea. Now I'd like to ask Rabbi Peretz Wolf-Prasson for his thoughts. Rabbi Peretz is both a longtime congregational rabbi and now an educator and historian and thinker of big thoughts at the Lehrhaus Judaica in Berkeley. Rabbi.
All right, so I have some small thoughts. The immigration system that brought my family, and I'm going to warrant, unless you're a Ohlone Indian or Miwok, all families here, has never been fixed. They keep calling it broken, but it was never one thing or the other. It's always been governed by either fear or greed, by necessities. And necessities are usually covers for choices. I find it ironic that despicable, we use the word necessity to cover really dogma or policy or feelings or wants and desires. So we're all here because someone warranted either necessary, and if you're not here, which means you perished in the Holocaust, it was necessary to keep you out. But that was someone's decision. Rarely was it based on facts. So, with that being said, yes, indeed, this is the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066. That's the order to intern the Japanese citizens and Japanese children of citizens in internment camps here in California, especially Northern California. And it was a very dark time, especially in the Jewish community. Lots of concerns, but there are a few bright spots. Usually people want rabbis to do. Please quote us Exodus one more time. Okay, one more time. The mitzvah most recorded in the holy scriptures of the Jewish people is to take care of the poor, the widow, and the stranger, which all have one thing in common. They're defenseless. So we are supposed to look out. So that's on the Torah portion, which was Exodus. I came home, hoped to take a nap, got a call from someone saying, go to the airport, we're gathering. Anybody here went on that weekend, Sunday or Saturday, to the airport? And I, a good number of people. And I saw the most amazing kind of intersection of many clearly written that morning or within a day posters and banners saying, my grandparents came here before the Holocaust, otherwise I wouldn't be here today. And I went up to these people, and I went up to people before the crowd got really big. I said, why did you make that sign? And they said, because I am a child of, or I am, or my grandfather was an immigrant to this country, or survived the Holocaust by luck, with help, and almost perished, or lost everyone except me. So we have some lessons to be learned about that. So we have, do we have the Jewish content taken care of now? The poor, the widow, and the stranger. Take that home, book that. But it's not so much what's written, it's how we live it out is most interesting to me. It's how a community responds. So if you're sitting here today, you might be in very, very good company. That's all I have to say at this moment.
Thank you, Rabbi. As I said before, I'm gratified that thousands upon thousands at multiple airports showed up the other night, because that is certainly not what happened at some of those internment camps or in Japantown, if it even existed. I'm not sure if it did at that time, but to defend those Americans as they were being carted off. I wanted to go around a little bit here and talk a little bit about what we can do. I think, maybe to kick off that, I'll throw this to John, who's at the ACLU, which has collected more than $60 million since the election. So that's another gratifying fact. Tell us, John, a little bit about how your organization may put the money to use and where you see having the greatest public impact.
Yeah, thanks. So the decisions we've made so far is that we're going to push that money back out to the states. The states are where the fights are going to be. The states are where the resistance is going to percolate. The states are also going to continue, in the case of California and a number of other states, as being laboratories for a more progressive, inclusive vision. And we don't want to let this presidency define just defensive work. There are places that are want to move forward in continuing to promote inclusive policies and values. And so just for one example, I think we're going to hire 40 new lawyers to work in our state offices, and we have an office in every single state. But it doesn't stop or end with lawyers. We're also going to be hiring organizers who in part are going to be educating people about their rights and what to do if they encounter a deportation officer or a police who's committing misconduct in their community. And we're also going to hire people who are doing political work at state houses, at legislatures across the country, and at city councils. So it's legal work through the courts, it's legislative work, and it's organizing members as well. Our first response to the types of things that Donald Trump was saying during the election was, if you try to do that, we'll see you in court. And now we're starting to say, and we'll also see you on the streets. We recognize that we have to create a strong political opposition, and there's opportunities now to do that. We just say one thing about the opportunity. We're talking about the reaction during the period of World War II and the types of anxieties and fear after the Pearl Harbor bombing and a war that we couldn't lose. But more recently for me, just because I lived through it as an advocate, was the period after 9/11. And it really does feel similar in some ways and different in other ways. The ways it feels different to me is we had a president at that time, George W. Bush, after the terrible terrorist attacks, whose popularity stood at 80%. And we had just suffered, a horrible attack that shook everyone in this country to its core. And I think courts were very timid about challenging the presidency over his judgments around that. And I think as a people, we were also felt timid or conflicted. We did not have the type of protest against the Muslim registry, special registration, that we had against this Muslim ban. And that was even true amongst Muslims. I mean, one of the things that's most interesting to me is a lot of the Muslim American community complied and thought that it was right to have a showing of good faith and loyalty. And I don't think that's where the I don't think that's where the majority of the Muslim American community is right now. There really is a spirit of very strong resistance, and we see that through the public reaction, through our politics, and through how courts are responding. Even in that very difficult environment post 9/11 for civil liberties, we were able eventually to change public opinion about things like the Patriot Act, which, remember, hardly a member of Congress voted against for. We were able to change courts' opinions about things like Guantanamo and a number of the other overreaches of the Bush administration. And I think that gives us hope for what we'll be able to accomplish now, even up against what seems to feel like such an overwhelming invasion of our civil rights.
Thanks. Griselle, you mentioned that so many immigrants have no understanding and no representation to know what their rights are. And one of those you mentioned was the right to an attorney, though so few, I'm sure, can afford one, as you also mentioned. But what you didn't mention is, what are the rights of an undocumented person? I have no clue.
Great question. This is actually a big chunk of the work that we're doing. And I forgot to mention another big piece of the work that we're doing. We've been active members of a lot of the local sanctuary, so-called sanctuary laws. So we helped write San Francisco sanctuary law, for example. But in terms of the rights, that is something that we really, really emphasize and lead with when we're speaking with the immigrant community especially. And I think that these things are helpful for everyone to know, because if you have someone in your life who feels like they might potentially be affected, you are also able to pass on and carry on this knowledge to others. So I'll run through them very quickly. They are easy. They can be communicated in a quicker fashion. So the right to remain silent, right? The thing that we see on Law and Order, that is a right that also applies in the immigration context as well. So in particular, if you are, if you are standing in front of an ICE agent, don't say anything. You can assert your right to remain silent. You don't have to tell that individual anything, not about where you were born, not about your nationality, not about, what you had for lunch that day, nothing. And that's incredibly important, because deportation proceedings, removal proceedings can't be initiated. Those proceedings can't be started without some evidence that that individual is a non-citizen, is not a citizen of this country. And many, many, many times, too many times to count, that evidence is sought from the individual themselves. Because ICE agents in all sorts of contexts will say, "Where were you born?" And the individual will say, "Mexico." Done. That easy. Because please believe, these ICE agents aren't telling people, "By the way, you have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. You have all sorts of rights. You actually might be able to fight your case, possibly for years, staying here with your family." They don't say any of that. So first, the right to remain silent is incredibly important. That's something that you can pass on to your family and friends. Another very important right, if an ICE agent comes to someone's home, I know right now everyone's hearing the word raid and they're terrified and they're petrified. Quick aside, that's a term that should be used very responsibly. Just because you hear the word raid doesn't mean that's what's actually happening, and it can cause a lot more panic to use and spread that word than it can cause assistance. So just quick note. Pause before and get verification before you use the word raid. But if an ICE agent is coming to someone's home, that ICE agent cannot enter without one of two things: either the individual's permission or a warrant signed by a judge. And, permission, don't give it, don't open that door. Second, with the warrant, they hardly ever have enforceable warrants. So a better practice is not to open that door. So if you're sharing this information, an ICE agent comes to your door, don't open the door, you know, just walk away, you know, leave them be. A follow-up question, you know, people will say, oh, well, what if the agents say that they have a warrant? What if they say, just open the door so that I can show it to you? Don't open that door. Tell them to slide it underneath the door if they have something. If you don't recognize what it is, you know what? Keep that door shut. That's sort of your better rule. So again, right to remain silent. Keep that door shut. And then the last thing that I tell people is not to sign anything without speaking to an immigration attorney. The thing is, it's super, super common for ICE agents to coerce people. The ACLU actually had a lawsuit over this, to force people to sign documents that end up being orders of deportation. So we do have very few rights in the deportation immigration system, but for many people, they will have the ability to fight their case in front of an immigration judge. You sign that order, that right goes away, you can be back in your home country in days. So don't say anything, don't open that door, and don't sign anything that you don't understand or without speaking to an attorney.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features a community forum on the recent executive order on immigration with Medea Ahusain of Muslim Advocates, Jonathan Blazer of the American Civil Liberties Union, Grisel Ruiz of Immigrant Legal Resource Center, and Rabbi Peretz Wolf-Pruzan of Lairhouse Judaica. They're joined by Peter Waldman of Bloomberg News. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
After 9/11, the Muslim community faced a tremendous amount of pressure on multiple fronts. And what is the feeling today? What is the climate today, you know, around mosques, around communities, in terms of pressure from primarily the FBI and law enforcement on things like trying to recruit informants and pressure people through visas and green cards and all the things that were going on after 9/11?
It's still very much there and evident. And one thing that I'll say that is true, according to what John was saying about how it sort of feels very similar to previous times in our history, right now feels very similar to right after 9/11, because when we talk about, for example, the impact on the community, the FBI data on hate crimes is released annually and has been for, I guess, approximately 15 to 20 years. They've been releasing this information annually. And after 9/11, obviously, we saw a significant increase in the number of hate crimes targeting the American Muslim community and those perceived to be Muslim as well. Just this past year, in 2015, the number of incidents impacting the American Muslim community went up by 67%. And that is the only category where there was an increase. All other categories of hate crimes went down. So there could be a number of reasons for that. It could be that community members are coming forward more, or that also that it's happening more. And in addition to that, surveillance is still happening. I think the attention might be drawn away and focused on other things, but surveillance is still very much an issue in the community. And communities are afraid to report hate crimes because they're worried that that's going to bring more scrutiny on their institution. So if there's an attack on a mosque, mosques are often hesitant to go and report it to the FBI, because then that might mean that the FBI agents are now going to be patrolling around the mosque, and we don't know what they're looking for outside of the mosque. So I think there is still very much a concern about surveillance, informants, recruitment, coercion for those individuals that have visas and green cards, and to say, oh, if you help us out, then we'll help you out. But then the next thing you know, they're put into deportation proceedings the next day. So these things are unfortunately still part of the practice of law enforcement. And in light of our new administration, we think it's very much going to be these are going to be tactics that are utilized across the board.
Certainly a great way to win friends in the community you need most to combat terrorism, right? With that, I'd like to turn this over to the audience.
I have a practical question. You know, I am very interested in seeing Donald Trump and his colleagues thwarted, removed if possible. And this is one particular egregious action, and it has to be fought. Now, it has been restrained by the court, particularly the Ninth Appellate Court, right here in San Francisco. We're on the West Coast. But I'm not sure the basis on which they constrained it, but I know they declined to rule with respect to the Establishment Clause. They specifically said they were not finding in that area. And yet, both attorneys, you know, leaned heavily on that as a means of opposing these measures and further court action. And so I'm concerned how strong that case actually is, because if you look at the Supreme Court with at least four originalists on it, and you read the Establishment Clause, and you say, well, I'm going to interpret this the way I think Thomas Jefferson may have read it, then I think maybe there's a real challenge there. So I'm curious of what the overall strategy and tactics are going to be to win that case, because you will eventually have to argue it.
Yeah, I would just say this. We're going to fight it in court, this is not going to be a case in which we know from the outset it's a total, complete slam dunk. But the fight itself is important, and as we fight Trump on this, it's one more step before he gets to the next thing on his to-do list. I mean, that's what the fight, I think, needs to be about. You're right. The Establishment Clause is the part of the First Amendment that prohibits the establishment of one religion over others. The executive order, if it's released tomorrow, will remove one of the most egregious and obvious violations of the Establishment Clause that was in the original executive order. In the refugee ban in the original executive order that is temporarily restrained by courts, they said that once we restart the refugee admissions program after the 120-day ban, we will give preference to minority religions in those seven countries. Minority means religions other than Islam, non-Muslim religions. So that's going to be taken out, I'm pretty sure, of the new executive order, and I think that is a gesture to the next court that looks at this to say there's nothing in the four square pages of the document that prefers one religion versus another. And they'll make some of the same arguments they made originally, which is, well, it's only seven countries. We haven't included every single Muslim country. It's a minority of the overall Muslim population in the world outside of the United States. So they'll make those arguments. But I think, as we both said, you can't take away the intent and the taint of religious discrimination, which our Constitution does not permit, will remain on this executive order, no matter how they revise it. And I believe that Donald Trump is too stubborn to fundamentally change the executive order to include a diversity of countries that pose a threat in one way or the other to the United States, and it will remain a ban of Muslim-majority countries only. I agree with you that it's not going to be a slam dunk or an easy call, but we will fight it tooth and nail.
I'm a Jew, and as a Jew, I feel it's our responsibility to speak out against the marginalization and discrimination of anyone, particularly if we're doing it. There have been parallels drawn tonight between similar but not the same events in our history here in America of discrimination against people from other places. The Emergency Quota Act, there was the way Chinese people were treated, immigration in the 19th century. But in those cases, there was no, to my knowledge, any history of terrorist attacks. In this case, even though I'm aware that there are no foreign-grown people having committed terrorist attacks in this country, there have been in other countries. These people have influenced people that have committed terrorist attacks in this country. My question is this. I haven't heard one nod or acknowledgement as to the justification or purported justification for these immigration restraints that we've seen attempted to be put in place. In my mind, the principles of the Constitution should be weighed like a scale, the legal scale, against the great deference that has historically been given to our president to protect us. Does anyone on this panel recognize that scale in this issue? And if you do, what kind of weight, if any, do you give it?
What kind of weight does one give it? Of course, one recognizes the constitutional role of the president in protecting the homeland. I mean, that he's responsible for the security of the United States. So I don't know that that's an issue. I think the issue is how you treat individuals versus how you treat communities. The president has a responsibility, and his law enforcement and security forces have a responsibility to ascertain individual issue, a background of an individual, and make sure that individual doesn't intend to harm the United States and do everything one can. The question here that I think all of us have been discussing is the targeting of groups.
Can I make a quick addendum to that? Targeting of groups and targeting of individuals simply because of their background.
Because of their membership in a group.
So whether it's an individual that may be perceived as a threat, but if it's simply because of the fact that they are a member of a particular group.
I think President Obama spoke to that and acted upon that in some of what clearly was, anyone would describe as enhanced vetting. I mean, it has not been easy for people from many countries to come into the United States for a long time. And that probably explains why we haven't had an influx of terrorists from outside the country. I was based in the Middle East for many years as a journalist and can tell you, spend a little time in front of an American embassy and try to get a visa is a long and in many cases heartbreaking situation. Someone else want to address that?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I really do. And it's an important one. I do think the perspective that you're sharing is one that the courts hold and is the one that they went into these cases holding. And I think each of the opinions, they recognize that the president does have a great deal of authority to protect our country and keep it safe and have a great deal of discretion. I think the reason why the outcome of these cases went the way they've went, you know, so far is that really President Trump and his lawyers were not able to offer any rational basis or shred of information that would enlighten the court as to why this particular policy makes our country safer, either in the way it was conceived or carried out. Now, I don't know whether or not there are some reasons that they haven't revealed to us, but they told courts across the country, I don't have to tell you anything. The president and his determination decided that this is what makes our country safer, and we're not sharing with you why. And that just doesn't cut it in terms of the balancing of considerations between civil rights, civil liberties, the anti-discrimination protections, and the other countervailing concern, which is quite important too, which is keeping our country safe. In fact, the court in Virginia that put down a ruling a few days ago said that the only evidence that was submitted on the record of the court as to whether or not the Muslim and refugee bans made our country safer said that it made us less safe because those who brought the case submitted an amicus brief from former security officials who talked about some of the considerations about creating animosity in the Muslim world. And the particular programs that they targeted, for example, a complete moratorium on the refugee program, that's the one group of people who want to come to the United States who are vetted most. In most cases, an average of 2 years abroad in which they do an up or down scrubbing of a small number of individuals. And in which it was implemented to apply to lawful permanent residents who have been coming back and forth in some cases for a couple of decades or more. So I do think you're onto something, and courts share your viewpoint, and it's going to be up to the Trump administration to be able to better explain why this particular policy is what's necessary and sufficient to keep us safe.
I'm going to add a little bit. I'm not going to say that you're an anxious person, but I'm going to say it's an anxious question, and it's a valid anxiety. So I'm going to speak from my heart because I think that was spoken from your heart. We are, at least I am, threading the needle between two kinds of dangers. There is a legitimate concern that refugees from certain Arab countries whose pedagogy is filled with anti-Semitism, oddly enough, imported from Nazi Germany, never before seen in the Arab world, but brought over by the Grand Mufti and brought over by others and deeply inculcated in the Syrian school, in the Syrian school school system as pedagogy, are also refugees. And there is an anxiety amongst many Jews that we're bringing into the country people actually do not have the Jewish best interest in their hearts. It's an anxiety. The other anxiety is against nativism, which is what is sweeping parts of Europe, Turkey, this country. It's not this president. It's the vast number of Americans who agree with this president, who elected him. He is the elected president of the United States. He didn't get there by accident, and have great fears of the other, which we've seen before, and we have often been, you mentioned the Chinese Exclusion Act, we brought them in, they built the railroad, and we sent them home. We've done terrible things, and terrible things have happened to us. So I think there is a kind of, there's not kind of, there is anxiety, at least I can speak for myself, of trying to figure out what is the right thing, both short-term and long. Am I doing the right thing ultimately, or am I doing the wrong thing immediately? And I'm not sure. If I was certain, I would tell you. However, there's one quote I've almost memorized. Fortunately, it's right here. It's a famous teaching that we've been doing for years and years. This is Martin Niemöller, 1892 to 1984. He's a Protestant pastor who spent 7 years in concentration camps himself because he was an outspoken critic of Nazism as a nativist movement. And he wrote in part, "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and then I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." I think the lived experience of the Jewish people has an allergy to roundups. At the same time, we have concerns about who's coming, who's going to become our new neighbors at the exact same time. And I think we're all trying to honestly balance out where we stand in this moment of history and trying to do the very right thing at the very wrong moment and be on the right side ultimately. If you feel unsure about that, you're probably an honest person.
Thank you, Peretz.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program was the Executive Order on Immigration, a community forum, featuring Medea Ahusain of Muslim Advocates, Jonathan Blazer of the American Civil Liberties Union, Grisel Ruiz of Immigrant Legal Resource Center, and Rabbi Peretz Wolf-Pruzan of Lair House Judaica. They were joined by Peter Waldman of Bloomberg News. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalay, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.